Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to FutureConEvents.com or email info@FutureConEvents.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome to another episode of And Security for All. I'm Kim Hakem, your host today, and I'm excited to be here. Happy New Year, even though it's going to be February 1st tomorrow. This is, I believe, I could be wrong, my first show I've done of the year. So welcome back. I had our guest host, Jonathan Kimmett, the CISO down in Tulsa, do our show last week. Thank you, Jonathan, for taking care of that. I was in Chicago. As many of you know, I'm the CEO of FutureCon Events, which hosts cybersecurity conferences all over North America. We just kicked off our first two events for 2025, and they were really amazing, but really hard to get back in the swing of things. We had Chicago and Dallas. Yesterday, we were in Dallas, and Dallas had a history rain and flash floods with our luck. It did impact our event a little bit, but fortunately, we stream all of our events. So the people that couldn't make it out in the morning were able to watch it virtually, but by lunch, excuse me, it was a packed house. So thanks for all of our sponsors and attendees yesterday that endured all that rain and bad weather in Dallas. So for any of you out there that would like to check out our events, just go to futureconevents.com. We have amazing speakers. It's an amazing event. They're usually all standing room only. My speaker today, I'm excited about our show today. I have one of our regular speakers who's from ESET, who's one of our premier sponsors at our event. I have Tony Anscombe, which I probably am messing up and I shouldn't because I've introduced him at our events over at least a dozen times at the very least. He's the chief security evangelist from ESET. And today we're going to talk about AI and cybersecurity evolution, risk, and future trends. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hey, great to be here.
Let's correct this now. How do I say your last name in the right way?
You got it pretty good, actually. It's Tony Anscombe. That was pretty good.
I think every time I'm on the stage, I'm like, I forgot to ask him how to fix his last name. I always feel like I'm mutilating it. So sorry about that. It's good to see you, Tony. Were you? Go ahead.
And you, Kim.
Yeah. Were you, my mind is so brain dead because we just did these two back to, and we were supposed to be in LA. We were supposed to have three back-to-back events, but unfortunately, because of the horrific fires out in LA, we pushed that back until March. So were you in Chicago or no? I didn't see you in Chicago, did I?
No, I haven't been at either of the two events so far this year, but hopefully I'll see you at some stage later.
Yeah, I'll see you soon because I'm usually at most of them. So anyway, well, Tony, I just introduce you on stage all the time and you always do such an amazing job with your topic. And I've never really got to chat with you too much because you're so busy talking to all the attendees. So let's talk about you a little bit and how you got into this role at ESET and how you got that title, Chief Security Evangelist. And tell us a little bit about your career and the growth of where you are now.
Well, it always makes me feel old when somebody says, tell you about my career. So I started life in the tech industry about 30 years ago. And I was a COBOL and Fortran programmer back in the day. So that's some time ago. And I actually started on the user side, so the corporate side, working for a number of finance organizations in the UK. So Chase Manhattan Bank, American Express, Schroders, and kind of went through the whole network management programming, then shifted across to Vendorville probably about halfway through, about 15 years ago.
And then how long have you been with ESET?
Well, I've been with ESET nearly 8 years.
Oh, so. Okay. It's a long time. So we like ESET, you know. They're, like I said, they support all of our events. You guys have a great team. So we appreciate everything ESET does working with us. But let's kind of talk about, you know, the kickoff of 2025 and a lot of things happening. Everyone's hearing about AI. I mean, now we're hearing it, you know, on TV with our new, you know, our new, the people running the White House, you know, and everything, they're talking about AI. So I definitely don't want to be political, but, you know, there's so many new trends happening. What are you seeing so far? Like, what are you seeing that might be a little scary? And what are you seeing that could be positive?
Well, I think you have to break the hype away from reality. Because as you just said, I think everybody's talking about AI. And I question whether they really understand what they mean by AI. I was in a shop over the holidays, Kim, and amusingly, I walked past the kitchen appliances, and there was a microwave that apparently cooks your dinner using AI. Yeah, which I very much doubt. I'm fairly sure it doesn't. So my point is I think companies and I think marketing people have latched on to the everything needs to be AI, and politicians are probably no different. But I think the interesting part about this is how did we get here? How did we get here so that we are all talking about AI, and why are we talking about AI at this moment in time? That's because if you go back a couple of years, of course, somebody made AI accessible to you and I. So they put language models in place that we could use natural language, ask questions, and get responses in text that we could understand that were generated from multiple sources. So ChatGPT and latterly in the last week and a half, DeepSeek. And I think that's why the hype is there, because suddenly you can interact with AI. It was there before, it was behind the scenes.
Well, and I definitely want to talk about DeepSeek in a minute, but AI kind of reminds me of when Zero Trust first came out. You know, it was like Zero Trust wasn't a product or a thing, and all of a sudden, every single company was a Zero Trust company, you know, and you Google Zero Trust, and now AI, I feel like you Google AI, and now every single company has something to do with AI. So it's, you know, I guess that's what draws people's attention to, especially if you go in a vendor room or a lot. We have been really fortunate, which includes you as well. Like our sponsors really provide us great, great speakers. So there used to be a day that, you know, sponsors would, you know, we try to keep it educational. But what do you think are some of the differences that you're seeing between different companies talking about AI and what they can do, and how are companies leveraging AI, and how are they using it as a twist with marketing and stuff?
Well, I think you need to look in depth about how somebody actually is using it, and how the history about what they're doing with the technology. You know, I think my microwave example was actually quite good, purely because it highlights that companies do latch onto these things. But there's, you know, you might be using AI for many different reasons, and it depends how in depth you're using AI. So for example, if I've got a management system and the management system is automatically prioritizing some events in the management system, i.e. Like a support system, yeah, that's AI. However, that's very different if somebody's using AI for cybersecurity, for example, and we're going to get into that, I know, but where you've got millions and millions of events happening and you've got all these bad things that you need to be looking at the same time, and then you need to be looking to see whether there's similarities. And like I say, we'll get into that. So I think you just need to dissect it slightly. And a lot of it is a subset of AI. So it's most of it that we actually see in the market really is machine learning, i.e. there's a big data set and the machine is learning from the data set and then making decisions based on the data set. Where AI, I think if you head off to Wikipedia and look at the actual definition they give to AI, it says that it's a machine that thinks for itself and isn't trained by a data set or a human. And I don't think we're quite there yet.
So tell us a little bit about DeepSeek and what it is and what that is. I honestly don't know. So
you're aware of ChatGPT, Kim, yeah. I assume. Right. So the algorithms that are used or the back end that is used to generate those responses, you ask it a question, it generates a response, are very resource intensive. So if you look at the power consumption of natural language models like that, they use a lot of processors and a lot of power. So a number of companies have done this. There's been huge investments into doing it. And suddenly we've now got DeepSeek, who have appeared on the market, a Chinese company, who claim and appear to be doing this in a less resource-intensive way. So they're using back versions of chipsets, less of them. So it's using less power, using less processors, but with a similar result. And I say similar because there are some differences, but bear in mind, they've only just launched. So they're a couple of years behind the rest of the market here. But I think while a lot of people are saying, well, how have they done that? How did they get the technology, et cetera? I think that's an interest, you know, there's a whole different discussion there, but actually technology does tend to leapfrog, doesn't it? I mean, you've been in the industry for a while, Kim, you know, you see something today and then somebody else innovates and comes up with a new version of it that's faster, improved and uses less resource, and then somebody else leapfrogs again. So I think it's just an evolution of technology. And if somebody has done it in a more resource, happy way, I'm trying to think of the right words there, but in a way that's using less energy resources, then actually we need to be embracing that, because I think you just said it was strange weather patterns in Dallas and climate change, and we all know that we need to be doing more for energy awareness, so less energy is a good thing.
Yeah, it is. We've seen so much evolution, and just this is nothing to do with DeepSeek, but it just made me think of just how much things have changed. I'm actually out at our ski condo in Utah, and my daughter was out here last weekend, and she hadn't posted anything about us skiing. And I posted one thing because it was Sundance out here, and I just posted something just showing that there was no one on the mountain. And then she was like, oh my God, all of her Instagram and all of her TikToks, were just flooded with ski stuff, And it's like, she hadn't posted it. It's just so creepy, I mean, but we do have some, we do have some devices, our music devices here. My home is a little more secure than our ski condo, but your Google devices are probably nowhere in Utah. And it's just so crazy how she's like, they all the ski stuff won't stop. And she had posted nothing. So it is, we're so vulnerable to whatever is going on out there,
We certainly are, and you're right. I mean, people share information sometimes when they don't realize they're sharing information. And in fact, I had a conversation with somebody a couple of years ago who insisted that the lampposts were listening to them. It's not the lampposts listening to them. It's the fact that they're sharing when they don't realize they're sharing.
Yeah. Because people still don't understand that if you have a Google device that's playing music, it's picking up what you're doing. I know that. And when I plugged them in here, my sound system at home is a more private wired sound system. But, when you're in a condo, you just take what's convenient, and you're making yourself a little vulnerable, but it's just the world we live in.
Yeah, well, I'm old school, Kim. I'm still a vinyl nerd, so you know, I still put the
well. That's
on
good.
The put the needle on the record.
So. You're living in a safe place then, you know. But
I certainly am.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, the old school is the way to be, you know. But then, you know, unfortunately, when you have, you know, younger, well, my kids are in their 20s, but they're still, you know, cutting edge of everything. And the whole TikTok thing, it going down for a day and then coming back is pretty comical to me. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. What are your thoughts about what happened with that?
Well, I think that's an interesting one, because I think there's a lot of politics involved there. You know, the data was moved under US jurisdiction a few years ago, wasn't it, when Oracle took on the data storage. I think with any social media, there's when you're collecting that much data about society, you know, there needs to be a concern around who's holding that data and who has access to it. But I don't think I'm close enough to know who does and who doesn't. My understanding was there was lots of protections put in place, but we'll see how that all unfolds. You know, what is interesting is there's an entire economy that is linked into TikTok.
That's what I was going to bring up. Seven million jobs, you know, people have made a lot of money, and that's what made me sad, is for the people that's their career now, you know?
Yeah. I think you just put it beautifully there that, yeah, you can't just switch something off that so many people rely on. I think I saw a number in an article that said it was like $25 billion of the US's GDP. So it's a significant size, it's a significant sum. So there needs to be a solution to it. You can't just switch it off.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's not as easy as people think, because one of my daughter's friends, I know we're kind of off topic, but she is a influencer, and you really do. It's a lot of work. You know, I had no idea, you know, it's running your own business. You know, you have contracts with these sponsors and you have commitments to these sponsors. Mm-hmm. So, because I'm always thinking, am I missing the boat? Like, that seems so easy. I work so hard, but they work just as hard, you know? So it's entrepreneurship on there, you know? So,
you don't think I should be mentioning my Ray-Ban glasses and,
and getting Ray-Ban to sponsor you? Maybe. Yeah. But anyway, kind of going back to AI, but a lot of it, you know, it's interesting. And TikTok, you know, they have a space in the cybersecurity place, you know. I mean, there's, you know, I know a lot of people over that work at TikTok, and, you know, I was talking to somebody at one of our events that was from TikTok, and they just said, we're just going to keep business as usual. So it wasn't like they were preparing to lay off all their people, because TikTok in itself has its own organization, a big company here in the United States, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, well, let's kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, how do you think AI is changing in cybersecurity historically? And, you know, I know that you've been at ESET for a long time, and how are some of the things that ESET is using AI? What are some examples of what you're seeing?
Well, so if you think about what you just said, you know, over the last few years, you've seen lots of vendors coming into your conferences where suddenly AI becomes very important. But I'll throw out a question to you, actually, Kim. What were you doing in 1997? You know, can you remember whose music you were listening to and what type of mobile phone you had?
Well, my first son was born in 1996, so that's the only reason, but I really can't tell you what I was listening to in 1997. That's all I can reference, is my kids were born in 97 and 96 and 98, you know, so that's all I can think of.
Yeah, so life was probably a bit of a blur if you were having children around that time.
That was right when I started my old company, which we won't mention. But that's what I go back to, is that was like kind of the beginning of my career, is when my kids were born.
So let me help you out there. So I had a Motorola TAC phone. if you remember the old flip Motorola phones with the little voice bit that came down, that was around that time. And Oasis were very much a band of that era. You might be aware that Oasis have reformed, and they're doing reunion concerts this year. But that's what that I mean.
Oh, Oasis, the band. Yeah, that's yeah. That you're right, because it was kind of like Nirvana. Mm-hmm. Now I'm remembering it, like taking my kids to school. You know what was on the radio. You know there was no Sirius back then. It was just good old radio stations.
So why did I pick on 1997? Well, the reason being is actually that's the first moment in time where, as a company, ESET actually started looking at using some elements of AI technology. Primarily, it was around, you might remember macro viruses. In fact, macro viruses have still been around in much in today and not quite so dominant now because some of the changes were made so macros don't run automatically or whatever. But macro viruses were a big thing then. And actually, we used some neural network technology back in 1997 to help with detection. So, you know, in the last 5 years, when you've got all these companies appearing on the market saying, hey, we've got the AI silver bullet, we can solve everything, we've got AI now for cybersecurity, it's like, well, hang on a minute, we've been using this for a long time. And I think we're now all very, very aware there truly is no actual silver bullet. It's a tool within the tool set of things, as opposed to it solving cybersecurity. But if we then kind of fast forward, you know, you said how have we used it over time. In 2005, we then added DNA detections. Now, if you think about files that land on your machine, they come from a certain place. They look in a certain way. That DNA detection, in effect, we created a characteristic fingerprint of a sample. So as the sample came to us, we would then look at it in turn and say, it has this DNA, it has these similarities. And then, of course, you know, if you think about crime dramas, when you think about a fingerprint, that's a partial print and we've got a similarity there. Or say, so they look for partial matching. We can do that the same way using our DNA fingerprinting DNA detection technology. So suddenly, if you do this for all files, so everything you see coming through, all traffic, then suddenly you know what's good and you know what's bad. So you don't just look at looking for bad things, you look to identify good things too. So you create both, which is where I think most people don't realize that as a cybersecurity company, we would, you know, that we would be looking for good as well as bad. Because if we understand what's good, then it helps us understand what's bad. So we create those distinctions. You know, over time, we've added things like LiveGuard, which allows us to understand the reputation of samples. So once you've got all the good and the bad, you know, we can then actually start looking at the reputation. How many people run that file? How many people, you know, where is it run? How often is it run? How often do we see it, etc. And then we build, we've taken some of that from the back-end systems and then put it into the client as well. So then as processors and machines become more powerful, you know, you can actually put that on the endpoint. All that makes sense, Kim. I mean, that's...
Well, I'm not as technical as our audience, so I know it makes sense to them. So I have a question, you know, when it comes to, you know, you think some... A speaker just brought this up last week in Chicago. They were doing a... and it may have even been our keynote speaker was talking about AI and some of, I think like when ChatGPT came out and OpenAI launched that, you know, I feel like there was a little bit of frantic out there that, you know, AI was going to take over so many different jobs. And are you seeing that happen? And what do you think in the cyberspace, in the security space, do you think that companies are going to start, you know, leveraging AI instead of human beings?
Well, so if we take this, there's a lot of questions
Yeah.
Right there. That was a lot of questions.
I know. And we can break that down. That was a lot, but I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about that.
So let me address the very first part of that about is AI going to take my job? Yes, there'd be jobs that AI does take because that's automation in the same way that we've seen automation in industry over hundreds of years. You know, if we go back to when steam power came along and created mills where you know, weaving cotton and fabrics and such like, you know, it went from somebody doing a job manually to a machine doing it far more efficiently and at scale. So it's not new, it's an evolution. Does it mean that society breaks down? No, society will actually go and find other things to do, i.e. there will be new jobs created by AI. You know, and if we look at some of the investments that are going on building data centers, generating more electricity to run the data centers, et cetera. So I don't see that it's going to be as dismal. There's no AI Armageddon coming. However, I think we need to be cautious on how certainly the media have hyped that AI Armageddon is coming in certain places. And if you go to places where maybe there's not as much of a great understanding about what is coming and how we will evolve, then it may be scary to people. So recently I gave a presentation in part of Africa, and clearly there's a fear amongst a lot of people in certain parts of Africa that they're not going to have jobs because this technology is just going to do everything for everyone, which we know is not true. And then I think if we bring this back to cybersecurity slightly, you can't do not everything should be done by a machine. Human expertise is really important. So I think I said at the start, you know, this is about models of you have large data sets and you teach a machine how to interpret the data set and then go off and actually do something based on the data that it's learned from. But to make sure the right data is in place, you need a human expertise and you need human oversight. So this isn't only about AI and machines, this is about human expertise as well. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that human intelligence is a really important part of actually AI.
Well, when you think about, I haven't seen, now have you been in a Uber that's been a driverless Uber?
Yes.
You have. How was it?
So I was in Phoenix.
I was just going to bring up Phoenix. Sorry. That's exactly where I was going.
So I spoke at an event in Phoenix in the last quarter of last year. Now, I lived in the Silicon Valley for a while. So I saw Waymo cars before they were Waymo cars, i.e. when they were regular cars with lots of sensors on them. I knew people over at Alphabet, so Google's parent company, who were driving these cars home. But they were, in effect, running up the mileage of being one of the sensors. So I've seen them from the early days, and then I've seen them where people have been sat in the car holding the wheel but doing nothing. I've seen then people were sat in the car in the driver's seat not touching the wheel and allowing the car to drive, and now you see them without drivers. So this evolution, I think, has puts me more at ease because I've seen that over many years. So when I was in Phoenix recently and there's the opportunity to jump in a Waymo and go back to the airport in a driverless car, I did so. Now, for me, I'm an early adopter, and it was super interesting, and it's super, super fun, actually, to jump in this car and trust it to drive. And it was, the experience was great. I then came back and turned and said to people, hey, I got in a driverless car. I had taken a little video and showed people, and they go, I would never do that. I couldn't do that. And there's an unease, a distrust. And interestingly, somebody said to me, well, what in a busy city, they'd never be able to cope. Now, that's interesting because I view it the other way around, that actually a driverless car in a city is going to be able to cope better than somebody who's going to be distracted by their coffee cup or by their phone or by other things that are going on or the radio. I'd probably trust a car more than I would trust another driver.
It is interesting. And I remember, and it could have been our event that you were out speaking at, because it was at the end of the year. And I remember being out there waiting for my Uber, seeing all those cars pull up. And I don't know why it didn't click to me that those were driverless cars. And then finally, after I left Phoenix, it came to me. I was like, oh, that's what they were. But I didn't even, it's not like it's on your Uber app. I guess, you know, people have to know how to get them. You know, I have no idea how you even request one. Did they have their own like app or?
Yeah, Waymo have their own app, and okay. you can register with Waymo, and depending on where you are and depending on availability, certain places where they launch it, they may put you on a wait list to register.
Oh, okay. Well,
there's less cars and whatever, but
there was so many in Phoenix. They were pulling up faster than the Ubers. And so, it's completely so interesting because I'm in Ubers all the time. I'm traveling all over the country. And, you know, my Uber that I just had the other day, you know, he was getting calls while we were driving, his music was on. So, you know, there's pros and cons. I think maybe once you get used to it, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I hate to bring this up because it's really bad timing because, you know, terrible thing that happened with that plane this week. But I wonder, you know, and gosh, our prayers go out to all those families. It's just scary for people like us that fly all the time. But do you think we're going to start seeing that in airplanes?
I think we're some way off of seeing it in airplanes, but if you see it further on the road, there are certain areas where I can imagine it becoming far more usable. So one of the issues that many countries have, including the US, is truck drivers. So you know, there's not enough truck drivers to move around, and then you get truck drivers going across the country. They turn up at a warehouse, and then they end up having to wait because there's a loading dock that's not free, etc. Yeah, if you could make all the trucks only drive at night when there was less traffic and they were automated and they only turned up at loading docks at the right time and they were driving more economically, then I can see that the truck industry might be good. I think the car industry is more challenging. And this is this very much is my own view. If I was going into San Francisco and needed to park, and I only had a 30-minute meeting with somebody, I'd be tempted not to park. I'd be tempted if I had a car that was with the ability to be driverless, I'd be tempted to tell my car to drive around for half an hour, which actually means you then end up with more cars driving around on the road without drivers in them, and more traffic, rather than it being the other way around. So I don't know. With cars, I think it's complicated. And the concept that we don't own a car and then you just share cars like that, I don't know about you, Kim, but my car's like my castle. It's like my own personal space.
Exactly. I agree with you. What are we seeing AI with, like medical, in the medical field? What are some of the changes you've seen there?
Well, some of the interesting stuff, I read an article recently about scanning. So, you know, if you go for a cancer scan, you know, roughly it takes a doctor, after you've had the scan, it takes a doctor around 2 hours to analyze the scan and to determine, you know, whether you have early cancerous. And of course, they're examining in great detail and in great depth. Whereas an AI model doing the similar job, and bear in mind an AI model doing that now, it would then be passed for review to a doctor. So it's not just an AI machine doing it. Does it in about 30 minutes. And it can then in effect pre-process the areas of concern for the doctor. So the doctor is then spending less time. So you're freeing up doctors' time to spend with patients or to see more patients than they are now, which is a good thing. Because, as you know, the medical industry suffers with not enough resource in the same way cybersecurity does. So there are good things. One of the examples I always think is interesting, Kim, and it is kind of moving away from the medical arena slightly, is facial technology. Because it's one of those issues that I think a lot of people are concerned about facial recognition technology, and rightly so, about the privacy. So, you know, if there's cameras everywhere, you know, should somebody be allowed to film you? And then what happens if they start using facial recognition technology and understanding you were there? So, you know, law enforcement or sports events or just walking down the street shopping even. And, you know, San Francisco is a great example. They passed some legislation a few years ago that actually meant that certain, I think, the state organizations weren't allowed to use the facial recognition technology. I'm not sure whether that's still the case, but they certainly delayed it or stopped it for a period of time because of these issues. And but it's not the technology that's wrong. It's how we use technology that sometimes is wrong. And the reason I say that is because in India, the government, one of the smaller regional governments in India, used facial recognition technology to repatriate lost children. In fact, it's actually it's not lost children. They're children that have been snatched and are traded. And they're used for begging or for selling things on stations or on the street, etc. So there's a whole unfortunate trade in trafficking children for work and for gain. But the authorities used it. They loaded it with 60,000 images of children that had been were missing, and they repatriated, I think it was 3,000 in the first 30 days. And this was a couple of years ago. And that's facial recognition technology. So is the technology bad, or is it how we use it that's bad? I think it's how we use it. We need to be really conscious about what we use technology for.
Well, recently I've been a little concerned traveling. I mean, I've been doing Clear for years, you know, so Clear, you know, it uses your eyes or your fingers and you don't have to pull your ID out. But now all the airports, then you go up to the TSA agent and they're taking a photo of you and they're like, it just goes away. I mean, it's a little concerning, you know, what are they doing with that photo and how secure is it? And, you know, are we becoming more vulnerable? Just, you know, what are the bad guys doing? How are they getting in there? And I reference that because I do use facial recognition to get into my bank, you know, on my phone. I would do a, you know, a MFA on it, but now I just do my face. But now you're making me think maybe I shouldn't do that because somebody probably could copy my face now since we're getting so many photos all over. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, most of the technologies, firstly, let me just share. I went through one of those systems. It wasn't a TSA. It was a passport check. I think it was Dallas. I came back into the country once through Dallas. And as I walked up to the desk, the guy actually welcomed me back to the US and gave with my name before I handed over my documents.
Oh, like, that's creepy.
That was really creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen anybody else do that, by the way, at immigration desk. maybe they stop them from actually being that creepy.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. And in that scenario, do you need to know who's coming in and out of your borders? Maybe. So maybe that's a good use of it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a bigger discussion. But. Could somebody take your facial recognition? That's actually a very, really challenging one to do. And the reason being is most of the facial recognition systems, for example, the ones that are used on your phone, look for sign of life. So even if you think you're staring at your phone really in a really hard, you know, hard stare and being really still, there are certain things that happen in your facial expressions, your breathing, et cetera, your eyes move, you blink. And actually the facial recognition systems for authentication typically look for that sign of life. So it's really, you can't just put a photo in front of it and make it unlock the phone. You can even try hold somebody else's phone and try and get it unlocked. Unless you're really in front of them and they're looking at the phone, it doesn't unlock. And that's because the algorithms that they're using look for those signs of life and the direction of where it's coming from, i.e. the person is holding the phone. So I think there's a lot of protections in there. The one I think I probably would avoid is voice recognition. Yeah, so I know some financial organizations try to put voice recognition in only. I think that's far more challenging and can be replayed easier.
Yeah, that one, that would make me nervous, you know. But since we probably have less than 20 minutes, let's kind of talk about cyber criminals and what they're using AI and how are they benefiting from it? And what are you seeing? Just kind of leads from, you know, just being worried, you know, how secure are we when we're using some of these tools, especially with your bank, with your financial institution, where that's your lifeline, you know, everything's there, you know. So what are you seeing the criminals doing with how is AI benefiting them?
Well, firstly, you know, are we seeing AI attacks? And the answer to that is no, we're seeing AI assisted attacks. Say there's not some machine somewhere deciding who to attack and going off and attacking. What you're seeing is AI, cyber criminals using AI as a tool set. So when they're developing a piece of malware or they're developing a campaign to come after their victims, they're using AI to obfuscate the code or to help them write the code or, you know, something we all see, improve the language in the emails they may use or the social engineering they may use. And I challenge anybody these days, actually, it's becoming really hard to actually spot what's phishing and what's not. You know, things land in my inbox and I'm challenged. So you know, the people that aren't looking for the things maybe I'd be looking for are probably even more challenged. So I feel that's a big issue. They're certainly using it. So they're certainly benefiting from it. Now, being somewhat cynical, why aren't they using it more? And that's because I think there's just so much opportunity. There's still lots of companies out there that haven't put multi-factor authentication in, who don't patch their systems fast enough. There's a lot of companies out there who just are not on top of their cybersecurity. So all the time that's happening, there's too much opportunity for somebody to do it the way they've always been doing it. And therefore, they don't need to make the investments or change gears and actually deploy AI to its fullest. Will they do it at some stage in the future? Yeah, of course they will. That goes without saying.
Yeah, I think I just heard, I don't know what speaker I heard, said, you know, you will get hacked. You know, I think that's what they said, you know. And do you think that's true?
Well, that's one of the things actually I don't like a saying. If you talk to cybersecurity people, they often say it's not an if, it's a when.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually don't like that because I believe if you take the right precautions, you follow the right frameworks, and you do all the right thing, you know, you really put the effort in. Actually, I think it becomes an if. I don't believe it's a when. So I don't agree with the people that kind of put it in those terms. And I've even used those terms before myself and have changed opinion. I think you can mitigate against cyber attacks. However, some of them are very sophisticated and potentially could come and get you or you could unfortunately be the victim of a zero-day attack. But I think it's less of an if. Less of a when and you know, more of an if you do the right things. You need to have the right cybersecurity posture in place.
Well, and you are talking, whoever said it, I don't know who said it, and I'm sure they were a great speaker, but, you know, kind of know your audience. You're talking to a group of cybersecurity practitioners, and I'm sure they were probably in their mind, well, no, we're not going to get hacked because I'm here, you know, like I'm working for this organization. It's our job to keep us from getting hacked, you know, but I think that the people that should be hearing that are the people that, you know, like look at the, I went blank on the, a couple of years, it's been three my daughter was graduating. It was her college graduation day when the big gas company, what was it in the United States?
Oh, Colonial Pipeline.
Yeah, Colonial Pipeline. I remember it was her graduation day and I saw it on the news and I was like, I had to leave to go to her graduation. But that was a company that was old school board members, you know, that didn't have any cybersecurity in place. So I think it's those kind of companies that still have that old school mentality of it's not going to happen to us, you know. And do you think that there really are a lot of enterprise companies out there that still have that mindset?
I think that, I think there's still a lot of opportunity. I mean, if you look over the last years, you've seen a lot of healthcare organizations get attacked or education. I think in those scenarios where they're focused on delivering education or healthcare, sometimes cybersecurity can fall to the wayside. And if you think about those organizations, both of them have, you know, rich amounts of personal information and data that has great value to a cyber criminal, one, to either exploit it directly or to use it and exploit it indirectly. And so I think there are, you know, unfortunately, significant opportunities out there still that present themselves, which cyber criminals take advantage of.
And do you... What about when you compare some of the larger institutions? I bank with a smaller business bank and I feel like they're doing such a great job. I notice it because I'm in the industry. Not many of their customers probably notice that I think they're doing a good job, you know. But what do you think the comparisons are to the larger financial institutions? But I've talked to CISOs from the larger institutions when we were in COVID and we used to do all these virtual bourbon events. I had the opportunity to talk to CISOs about what they were doing, you know, in their organization. And, you know, they have the funds to do a lot more things. So what do you think the differences are between the two?
Well, I read an article about a year and a half ago, Kim, which actually looked at a water utility company, because one of the areas in the US that I think is challenging is some of the smaller utilities. And if you look at that industry, there's 53,000 different providers of water utilities in the US. So actually getting them to a point of cybersecurity is really challenging. Many of them are very small. Yet it's a critical infrastructure and something that if you damage the water supply could have devastating effects. But whilst I was looking at that, I looked at the comparison. So I looked at the budgets and funding for a local water utility on the West Coast where I was living at the time. And they were spending, I think it was like half of 1% of their income on IT, yet alone cybersecurity. Whereas if you look at a construction company, they spend about, I think it's about 3%. So, and then if you look at a finance organization, I think it's like 5% of their revenue profit goes on spending on cybersecurity. And some of that is because, of course, they're a regulated industry. Because the regulator has put in place requirements for security and they can get fined if they don't do these things, and that, you know, there's great reputation damage, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I think the mindset is different. And, you know, from a board that's running a small nonprofit water utility in a rural area to a finance house who's highly regulated and at the mercy of legislation around privacy law and financial regulation, then I think there's a lot more money available for them to actually go and put cybersecurity in place.
Well, it is just interesting. I know last year when we were in Kansas, and his title was bigger than the CISO of the state of Kansas. And he was talking about just all the little municipalities, just how rough it was for them, you know, and especially, you know, the utilities. And they just don't have the finance, you know, the money to, you know, protect themselves. And they're just, you know, he said, I can only imagine the stuff we don't know, you know, with, you know, and that's always been so concerning to me is the water.
Yeah, it's those smaller organizations, Kim, where you have one limited funding but also two limited resource. I think that's one of the big things, is they don't have the people with the skill sets and the expertise that need to understand what they should be doing or to actually operationally run those things. So that's why, you know, for example, at ESET, you know, we provide MDR services and threat intelligence. So that's why it's important that companies like that actually take the benefit of outsourcing and allow other operational staff to sit there and monitor your network and actually look to see what's going on, to monitor those systems for you. Not everything has to be done in-house. And I think that's super important. And, you know, when you look at something like our MDR system and our threat intelligence, both of those utilize some very sophisticated AI technology to look at the data that's going on. So if you think of an organization with maybe 1,000 devices, and all those devices are passing every process that opens, every piece of traffic that goes through, every connection they make, all of that telemetry coming from those devices needs to be analyzed. You need to look for the anomalies in it. So this is where those advanced AI algorithms step in and actually determine what's good and what's going on, and whether there's something bad or something unusual happening on the device, and then flagging it either to an external analyst within the MDR system, or flagging it back to the internal team and saying, you've got this one incident over here, go and lock this workstation down, or we've automatically disabled this workstation, please go look at it and fix it. I think a lot of those smaller organizations really need to be outsourcing in that way and using an MDR service.
So maybe we have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about, where do you think AI goes next?
Well, it's Armageddon. No, of course it's not Armageddon. Firstly, I'm going to get my dinner cooked by a microwave that uses AI, which is not going to happen either. But
I don't even know how that would work. I can't even fathom that in my mind. So
if I had more time and effort, if I had more time and energy, I'd have probably gone and had fun with the salesperson in the store and asked them to explain it, and they wouldn't have been able to explain it.
No. But
where do we go from here? Well, AI will further enhance technology. So I mentioned threat intelligence. Yeah, you've got automated incident creation, and you've got the automation of some of these tasks. Now, is this doing away with security analyst jobs? No. There is such a shortage of good cybersecurity people out there that actually, we're automating it and allowing the cybersecurity people that are in place to only look at the really interesting things and keep them focused. So and where does it go beyond here? I think threat intelligence is becoming more important as more telemetry around the world becomes seen. An incident happens in Asia overnight. By the time you will wake up in the US, you should be protected from it because it should be an automated process. Where does we go in society from AI? Well, I don't know. I think I'm going to put my tin hat on and go and live in the woods at some stage, away from the TikTokers.
Well, it is, talking about kind of ending on a fun note, when you think about AI, like your fridge, I've heard that, this would be perfect for me because I'm never home, and and to have your fridge tell you, hey, your ketchup is expired, your milk is expired, you better throw it away, to have your fridge talk to you and tell you what to get out of your fridge. And I mean, it's happening. I think that would be I'm due for a new fridge soon, so maybe I'll have to look into something like that.
But here's the point then, do companies then start putting shorter expiry dates on, knowing that they'll get reorders automatically because it's an automated? I don't know. I think we need to think hard about how things like that are used, and actually how companies might exploit the fact that you're automating tasks that, you might look at the ketchup and go, the last time I used ketchup was 3 months ago. I actually don't need one.
Yeah.
But the fridge ordered it for you because it had expired.
That's so funny. And some fridges, I have a nice fridge, you know, it keeps things really, really cold. So it might be expired, but really it's not, you know, like ketchup, you know, this ketchup, you know, is, I don't know. My kids always get on me about the expiration dates of things in my fridge. So that's why I thought about that when they come home. I'm like, well, no one's living here anymore to eat my food. So, But it is interesting where it goes and how society, you know, the things. I mean, that's a perfect example. What a great marketing for, you know, the alliances of the companies that are in your fridge, you know, for Heinz ketchup or Heinz ketchup. I just secured Heinz, the CISO. So Heinz was on my mind. So Heinz ketchup. So, tell us, is there anything, any words of wisdom from, you know, you being an evangelist of what people can do to just keep their own little world safe and secure and what we can do on a daily basis and, you know, how to not get taken by some of these scams of AI?
Well, there's a few things from a business perspective and in fact, from a personal perspective. I think one of the big things is, you know, you hear a lot of cybersecurity people turn and say strong passwords, etc. You know, MFA, please turn on the multi-factor authentication, the two-factor authentication, whatever it's called. You know, make sure that whenever you open an account personally, you turn it on. But if you're in business, make sure it's on by default. Yeah, this is a great way of stopping credential or at least limiting credential theft and making it very difficult for somebody to access systems. The other one is patching. Yeah, unfortunately, there's lots of software out there, lots of devices with software on them out there, and they have known vulnerabilities. Yet patch them. When there's a patch available, please patch. It's one of the most, these are some of the really fundamentals, but unfortunately, mid-sized companies, smaller companies, even some big enterprises don't do this fast enough. And that's where, you know, cyber criminals unfortunately then exploit it and get access to systems. So, vulnerability patching, two-factor authentication, those are the two big things I'd say we really need to address.
Well, Tony Anscombe, is that how I say it? Anscombe?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Chief Security Evangelist from ESET. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm sure I'm going to see you shortly at one of our events, but thanks so much for spending the last hour with us. And you guys can just find him on LinkedIn. I'm sure that is at the best place for people to get in touch mm-hmm. with you. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for being here today, Tony. And thanks everyone for tuning in to another episode of And Security for All. We are going to be in Baltimore and Detroit for the month of February, FutureCon, and we'll be back here next Friday. So everyone, enjoy your weekend. Stay safe, stay secure, be aware of what you're opening, and have a fabulous weekend, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for tuning into And Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hakim, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific time and 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hakim. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. Miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hakim, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.